This is Hal Hester, lead pastor of Vine Life, and this is our podcast, The Empowered Word. I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope this message inspires you, builds your faith, and gives you perspective on what God is doing in your life. Please enjoy the message.
Good morning. Hope everyone is doing well. Hope that you've had a great weekend. I had a great weekend. My team won. I don't know about yours, but anyhow, good to see you. Good to see you. Hey, before I get into the message this morning, heads up. We have the Bloodmobile coming October 10th. And so I wanted to make you aware of that, because if you are a regular blood donor like I am, one of the things is I have to like think about when something like that's going to happen, so I don't go and just the week before give blood, you know, at my normal place. So I wanted to invite you, if you are a blood donor, or if you've never given blood before and you'd like to give blood this time, there is a critical need for blood in our community. Actually, right now, they are doing everything they can to get people to come in and give blood. And so here on October 10th, that's just two Sundays away, we're going to have the Bloodmobile here, and I hope that you will consider participating in that. I know sometimes people can't, certain medications, health issues, or whatever else, or if you've recently given and you're just, it's not time in your cycle of giving to be able to give, but I purposely postponed a week just so that I can do that. And so I hope that you will be a part of that with me. All right, this morning we are continuing in Genesis. Today, one of the things we're going to do, we are going to kind of do a little overview to bring us up to speed for a couple of reasons. One, just in case you weren't with us last time, it could be part of it. But also, this is a really critical point in the conversation about what's happening with Joseph and the move of the brothers to Egypt and how this is all unfolding. Now, last week we were in chapter 42, and we talked about Joseph's brothers having come to Egypt to get grain, where they encountered Pharaoh's steward, who, unbeknownst to them, was their brother Joseph, whom they had sold into slavery about 25 years earlier, doing the math there. So now Joseph recognized them, but rather than punish them, he decided to test them because he believed that it was God who had sent them, that God had put them into his hand, and that this moment that that they were experiencing, that God had orchestrated all of these things. He really believed that God was at work in his life, actually through the midst of all of his crises, through all of his suffering and his pain. He really believed that God was the one who had orchestrated it and now brought him to this place of greatness, of power and authority in order to preserve life. So when Joseph saw them come in, he sets a plan in motion by arresting one of the brothers. And in this case, he's not arresting them in a punishing sense. He arrests Simeon with the charge of spying, actually treats him better than people would normally be treated in prison, demands that the others then must return with their younger brother to prove their innocence. Now, in that whole process, upon their return to Canaan, Jacob, their father, refuses because Benjamin has now become Jacob's favorite, just like Joseph had been the favorite. He's not learned any lessons about this and continues to position the children against one another, devalues the older brothers upon the death of Joseph. And so, unfortunately, he hasn't learned anything through this process. But even as he's wanting to continue to protect Benjamin, the reality is that he cannot survive without the grain of Egypt. God is orchestrating this so that he is dependent upon Egypt, and in Egypt is his son, whom he is desperately grieving over, and he has no idea that God is orchestrating these things. Eventually, he then has to relent and allow his son Benjamin to go with the other sons back to retrieve Simeon so they could buy more grain. Now, in that process, Joseph, who is also known through these chapters as Zophnath Paneah, let me hear you say that 10 times fast. They are coming to this Egyptian, and they have no idea that they have been set up in order to test them. First by luring Benjamin to Egypt, and then by seizing the younger brother. It is Joseph's plan to reveal their hearts, to know what exactly is going on in their minds. Now, and part of this, his thought is that he is going to also protect his younger brother, the son of his mother Rachel, and to see what is going on here. In part, he's questioning whether or not only have their hearts changed toward him for what they did, but also in how they're relating to one another. And so a lot of testing to be done in this. It's a very well-devised plan to reveal their hearts. And to Joseph's surprise, his brothers do not abandon their brother Benjamin in his hour of need, or their brother Simeon in his hour of need. And that's where we pick up. We're going to actually be in Genesis chapter 44, starting in the middle of the chapter. I could read all of 43, 44, and 45, and which would be, you know, fine with me, but probably by the time I got to end of reading that, you'd be ready to go home. So we're going to start in the middle of chapter 44. If you would, if you're using a phone or a tablet, please set that to silent for the comfort of those around you. I'm going to read from the English Standard Version. You follow along in whatever translation you have there on your lap. That is my favorite translation. Let's take a look here. "And when we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. And when our father said, 'Go again, buy us a little food,' we said, 'We cannot go down. If our youngest brother does not go with us, then we will go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us.' Then your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife, bore me 2 sons. One left me, and I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I've never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm happens to him, you will bring down my gray hairs in evil to Sheol. Now therefore, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, as soon as he sees that boy is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray heads of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father." Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." And so no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, And there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve a remnant on the earth and to keep you alive for many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and the Lord of his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. For you shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that this is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all of his brothers and wept upon them. And after this, his brothers talked with him. Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. Can you imagine that scene in your mind? Can you play that in your head? The moment of distress, the moment of revelation, that hearing that for the first time, that narrative that the family has been sharing, that edited version of what really took place. Some crazy stuff right there, isn't it? I mean, like Jerry Springer would be proud. Reality TV has nothing on the Bible. What was it like for Joseph to hear the official family narrative of what happened to him? Knowing the truth, holding in, what kind of rawness might there have been in those emotions? Would you imagine Joseph to maybe been angry on some level? To think about all that has been lost, then watch his brothers squirming, knowing that they have been found out by the Lord. For the first time, he knows why his father never found him, that the story has been that he was torn apart by animals and that he was dead. Wow. At the same time, look what's happened to these brothers. Even though they have lied, and by lying, I mean they have twisted the truth, right? I mean, sometimes we conveniently don't call that lying. We call it omission. We call it telling the story in a way that's favorable. They lied. When we do it, we lie. And so he's hearing this fabricated story, and yet in it, recognize this. They do take blame for his fate. And they are saddened by their father's loss. There's no way that they want to tell the Pharaoh at that moment, it was our fault and we sold our brother into slavery. I mean, they're trying to position themselves as to look at like good people, are they not? Isn't that usually how we tell the story when we're guilty is, even when we know deep inside, even when there's a sense of remorse, that we can't actually just lay the story out because it's too convicting, even for ourselves. I mean, there's those moments, even when you and I find ourselves in prayer and we know that the Lord knows the whole story. And yet, as we pray, don't we soften the way that we say those things, even to the Lord in the quietness of our hearts. There's rarely that kind of just coming clean, that kind of rawness in which we would say to the Lord, I was horrible. My soul is ruined within. I can't believe that I would have stooped to that level, that I would have behaved that way, and I know better. And it's rare that we are ever that clean, even in our own private prayer lives. Some have suggested that to recognize the ruinedness of our own soul is just more than we can cope with. That to take time to ponder that might lead us to a sense of despair. I don't know that that despair would always be necessarily all bad if it brought us to a moment of reckoning where we would so heartily abandon everything except seeking God. But I think it's really true. Nobody wants to see their own ruin. And certainly not before the man that they're trying to convince that they're not bad people, right? I mean, they're just, like everyone else. Because we're all just kind of good people, right? I mean, isn't that the official narrative? And then there's this whole issue of Judah. Remember, it was Judah who suggested, don't harm the boy, but let's make a profit off of him and sell him into slavery. And now in this moment, it is Judah who offers himself to be the slave. There has definitely been a reckoning in the heart of Judah, hasn't there? If you'll reflect just a little bit over some of the things that we've talked about, we didn't actually read that chapter specifically, but we've talked about it over and over, that Judah, in the middle of all of this, moves away from the rest of the family because the memory of Joseph haunts him so. And Joseph finds that out right now in this moment. He doesn't know the story about how Judah moved away from the rest of the family. But he does know this, that Judah, the very one who gave him over, who suggested that they sell him to the Midianites, is now the one who's not only begging for Benjamin's life, but offers himself in his stead. Greater love has no one than to lay down his life for a friend, right? I mean, that is what he's saying. Take me, but spare the boy. Spare the boy for the boy's sake. Spare the boy for my father's sake, whose life I have already destroyed. Don't do this. And it's in that moment that Joseph recognizes their sacrificial nature, their willingness to come back, the willingness to do everything they could to save Simeon. Simeon, remember, was the one who didn't want anything to happen, who said, do not lay a hand on him. Judah, now the one who was a little less, didn't want to kill him, but then wanted to sell him into slavery in order to you know, and here in the middle of all of that comes to this point of willing to sacrifice himself. You know, as Joseph was encountering his brothers over the last few chapters, it tells us that there were several times where he comes to a point of tears. But it also tells us that he was using an interpreter, and so he took those moments to just kind of step away and get control of himself. You ever done that? Stepped away so that you didn't respond fully in the way that you wanted to respond? Maybe your motive was simply that you saw it would spiral things out of control. Maybe you saw that in that moment, in the case of Joseph, where the ruse that he is using to test them, if he reveals in that moment, if he begins to weep, he knows that he'll never know that what's really going on in their hearts. And so he steps away. But now he fully knows. Now there's a full sense of revelation. He's seeing their hearts on the line. He's seeing that their actions and all that they've gone through to fulfill the things that the requirements that he's made of them, and he just can't contain it any longer. And he breaks out in just a very passionate moment and begins to cry out, and so that everyone leaves the room. Get out of here! Can you imagine for just a moment what it was like to be his brothers in that moment when the steward of Pharaoh kicks everyone out and is crying and raging? I bet you they thought that was it. I don't know why this guy is after us. But now, we're done. I wonder what was going through the minds of the Egyptians. Did he cue anyone in to what was actually taking place? It doesn't say so in the text. You have to wonder maybe if there was some other conversations. But on the other hand, maybe not. On one hand, I could tend to think, because he's already promising them the land of Goshen, that maybe there's already been some conversations with Pharaoh about what he's going to do if things play out well. On the other hand, I mean, he is the ruler of all of Egypt. I guess he can do whatever he wants. I wonder what was running through the minds of his staff, of his people that were around. I wonder what was going through the minds of the brothers. And so everybody leaves the room. Emotions are on full rage. And in that moment, Joseph is relieved to be able to tell them his true identity. What an emotional moment. Not only for Joseph, but for the brothers, right? And for Joseph, it's a moment of relief. I finally get to tell you what's happened. I finally get to tell you about what God's been doing. I finally get to tell you how those dreams really were about this. And it wasn't about me being exalted then. It was about my need, you know, to make this journey and to go through all of these things so that we could preserve life, so that when you bow down before me, it wasn't so that I could lord over you, but so that I could preserve your lives. There's so much to tell. But I promise you, that was not the thought on Joseph's brothers' minds, right? I mean, a moment ago, they were standing before a magistrate who had the power of life and death over them, who had the ability to give them grain, who had put them in this precarious situation, but he didn't know them. We're being treated oddly, and we don't know why, we don't know what's happening, and we have a deep sense that this is judgment coming upon us because of the way we treated our brother Joseph. This has all come back. It's finally come to roost, and we could not escape our guilt. And so we deserve this in a, like I said, kind of karma kind of mentality. But now, in their minds, I want to tell you, this has gone from bad to much worse. Right? This is now the guy that you threw into the pit, the guy that you wanted to murder, the guy that you left for dead. This is not just some steward who's cranky. This is not some steward that's questioning who you are. This is the steward who knows exactly who you are, and you are the one who sought his death because he was difficult. He wasn't very nice to us. He told our daddy things that we did. Oh, man. Like the kind of stuff that people whine about every day, right? the guy we don't like at work, the boss's pet, the brother or sister who's got mommy's or daddy's ear more than you do, or even as adults, we like have, you know, I don't know how many times in doing funerals, the worst part in doing a funeral is that kind of stuff. All the pettiness. And that pettiness is about to cost them their lives. That's their thought. In our pettiness, we were willing to take his life, and now he has full authority to take our lives. Man, I bet there was some real heart check going on that in that moment, their lives flashing before their eyes, thinking through that whole process. The power to crush them. Consider the lesson from Joseph's life, though. The next time you are faced with a situation in which you are tempted to respond in kind, not just an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. Remember, that is biblical in the sense of that it's a limit on our response. It's a limit on this kind of response. It's the typical response of, I'm going to get even. You know what even is, right? That's when I do the same thing to you and plus a little bit for my pain and suffering. We even do that in the courts, right? I mean, you know, we don't just sue somebody for the money that they cost us or the damages or whatever, and then we throw in this catch-all phrase for pain and suffering. That's called getting even. It's called retribution. What it really means is something to satiate my bloodthirst. That we have conveniently justified under the words of, well, anyone else in my situation would have done the same. And so don't you and I have to ask ourselves the question, why does Joseph not do what anybody would do? Now, your answer, of course, conveniently is there in the text. I mean, you know, that Joseph has learned these wonderful lessons, right? I mean, but I want you to think for just a moment how he has learned those lessons. Is it normative for what, like when people like go to prison falsely, that they come out, you know, like thoughtful, reflective, patient with other people's weaknesses? I mean, is that generally the way people come out of prison? I mean, when you think about someone going to prison, do you go, man, that really softened them up and made them tender to the Lord? Is that the thoughts that you have when you think about someone going to prison? I've never had that thought. Could be because I've actually worked in prisons and, you know, going out into the weight yard with prisoners, I've never once heard somebody as they were pressing weights going, you know, every time I'm lifting these weights, I think about the heavy burdens that have been placed upon me and how I should process that. No, they're like saying, you know, I lift these weights so that whenever I get out, I can squeeze the head of the person who put me in here. Would you like to talk about Jesus? Joseph, in the worst possible of scenario, right? I mean, and even, wouldn't it have been pretty easy to simply look at those dreams and just said, see, God was giving me something to hang on to, and one of these days they're all going to bow before me and I will get my just dessert. If the first thought in your mind is simply, well, I guess Joseph is just a better person than I am, well, sadly, then you'd be right. But that's not a It's not an excuse, is it? I mean, it's a painful reality, but it's not actually an excuse. It's not a justification. See, Joseph became the better man in the kind of situation that would have continued to crush most of us. And the reality is that the Joseph who found himself going through that was a Joseph who was absolutely, absolutely less of a man. The Joseph who was thrown into the cave was a brat, an entitled brat. The man who was sold into slavery, even as he pleaded for his life, not somebody that was reflecting on what could have got him there in that moment, but just wanting to preserve his life, right? Like anyone would. The Joseph who was the steward of Potiphar's household, the Joseph who was the steward of the prison. There's a reason why it took those 20 some odd years for God to work through that whole process and bring them to a point that this moment would happen. And a significant part of it was Joseph's heart had to change to become the man who would be prepared for this hour to behave this way. Likewise, it took those 25 years to process the heart of Judah and of Simeon and of all the brothers to bring them all to a point like this. And so they find themselves in this moment. And this moment could be the moment of reunion, or it can be the moment of revenge. And the answer is, God helped Joseph to take his eyes off of himself and his happenstance so that he could see God's hand on his life. And slavery and prison, hardship, difficulty, pain and suffering broke him. But in the midst of his brokenness, he let God rebuild him. You know, typically when we use the word brokenness, what we mean by brokenness is this. We mean our woundedness. We mean the casualties of our sin. That's usually what we say. When we talk about brokenness in the church, what we usually mean is, when we say we're broken, we mean I've been hurt. What we usually mean is there has been a calamity and disaster that has come my way, so I'm broken. And maybe we blame that on our parents or the way we were raised, or we blame it on people in our life. We blame it on ex-wives, ex-husbands, badly behaved other people, and we point to that kind of brokenness, our wounds. And those are real, and they really do break us. But Joseph's ability to cope and to be ready in this moment wasn't the brokenness of his circumstances. It was the brokenness of in realizing his part in that, his own sin. His own attitude, his own actions, his own behavior. Because I guarantee you, if all you do is focus on the woundedness, that kind of brokenness, it will just continue to fester, and it will just continue to give you the reasons why to justify the behavior later on. See, if all he had done was learn from it that he was broken, then he would have just said, this is the way I am because of my history, and I can't help myself. I mean, that is the mantra of our day, isn't it? I mean, I can't help myself. And there is an element of truth to that. You can't do it alone. But by the power of God within, there is the ability to renew and to pluck him not just from his woundedness, but to help him recognize his true brokenness, his sin brokenness, and to make choices about how to live differently, behave differently, evaluate the world around him, evaluate what's happening to him, his contribution in it, and begin to think all of those things, and then surrender himself to the Lord for real healing. Not just the healing of his woundedness, but also the healing of his inner man, so that he'd be in a place that the day they were brought before him, that he could forgive, so that he would be compassionate, less judgmental, prone to forgiveness. I don't know about you, but I don't typically think of what a guy like Joseph had been through and say, those usually make a person happier and less given to anger and revenge. So in those moments, I want to think to myself, like, God, what were you doing in him that I want you to do also in me? So that I could be like a Joseph in those situations, when those things are thrust upon me, when trials and circumstance come my way, not in the absence of them, but in the midst of them, not just before them, but even as they're ongoing, because life tends to be like that. There's a lot of things that come at us and hit us and beat us down and everything, and that we live in a world that by its very nature is fallen and broken. And so I don't get time off, really, do I? Is there enough time for you and me to take off and to escape into the mountains where no other sin or other brokenness will come to us so that we could get our act together before coming back down the mountain? The desert fathers tried that. They went out and lived out in the wilderness of in Alexandria, you know, northern Egypt, things like that, and hung out thinking that somehow if they just stayed out there long enough on a pillar of rock and prayed enough that they would get down from the pillar and that they wouldn't have those problems anymore. Guess what? The problems followed up the pillar of rock. The problems found them in the desert. Because most of the problem is, well, in the mirror. And so it's in that context, Joseph, in the midst of trial, difficulty, and circumstance, finds the power of the Spirit at work in his life, that he humbles himself before God, and he decides to learn what no man can teach. So God instructs Joseph, helps him to take his eyes off of himself and off of happenstance. I know I've said this before, but do you know the word happy and things that happen don't sound similar for no reason? They're from the same Latin root. It means that something occurs and then you have a response to it. So happiness is the idea that my emotions are dependent on my circumstances. And if you're waiting around to be happy, well, while our Constitution might guarantee the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't guarantee that you will find it. And so, instead of focusing on happenstance, he sees the hand of God on his life. Slavery in prison does break him, but God rebuilds him. And in those moments when I read a story like that, the strength, the energy I find in that passage right there is, you mean that God can use even the most unbearable of circumstances to make me better if I choose not to be bitter? But circumstances don't dictate our outcome. So if I find myself resistant to change, resistant to God, I can think of Joseph's exile of 20 plus years and think to myself, I think I'd rather yield. Right? Moses, 40 years in exile, comes why? Because the Israelites would not change, because eventually he literally had to let an entire generation die off so that the next generation could inherit what God wanted to give to the previous generation. Man, what kind of lesson is that? And you know, here's the thing is that we, as you and I go through the scripture and we look all the way from Genesis to the book of maps, we just see that as the repeat pattern over and over, right? That cycle of apostasy, of believing and God in those times of being crushed and difficulty and circumstances, and they turn to God, and then God rescues them, and they go, yay, God! And then when everything's going okay, then they start to turn their eyes on themselves and make themselves their own gods again, and then they like end up right back in the place where they have to be crushed by their circumstances so that they will begin to lift their eyes toward heaven and be renewed, and it goes over and over and over and over. And at some point, like when you read those things and you're like reading, it's hundreds of years and all this, you'd think that somebody would like have learned the lesson. And yet, before I can point the finger at Israel for not learning the lesson, well, you and I have the entire story, right, of Israel. When do we learn the lesson? And so the Israelites spend 40 years in the wilderness. Moses ends up there with them. Joseph, 20 years. They spend 40 years. And then there's Jesus. 40 days in the wilderness. Just completely submitted to what the Father wanted to prepare his heart to get ready to do for the next 3 years so that Jesus could lay down his life. In each case, God used circumstances of testing. Even Jesus went through testing. What are the odds that you will escape? And so God uses this testing to prepare them to do God's will. And the difference between Jesus' 40 days, Joseph's 20 years, or Israel's 40 years is all about our willingness to see what God is doing and to just submit ourselves to His will for our life, to allow God to use those circumstances to shape us, mold us, to prepare us for vocation. You know, I'm convinced that some people will spend their entire lives in the wilderness of testing only to go for their gray head to go down to Sheol completely unresolved. And that breaks my heart. See, I'm not talking about going to hell because of your sins. I'm talking about people who know the Lord and are in relationship with Him and live a life that is completely without any kind of victory or sense of triumph or a sense of joy in the midst of their circumstances. And can I just tell you that all too often that's the condition of the heart of the church today, is that there is no actual witness on our part. The only witness that we have are the words that we say when we tell everybody what's wrong with them, what's wrong with the world around us, what's wrong with our politics, what's wrong with this, what's wrong with that, what's wrong, what's wrong, what's wrong, what's wrong, what's wrong. Oh, that's so attractive, isn't it? And what do they witness? Why, y'all complain a lot. Y'all a bunch of miserable... Yeah, boy, I can't wait to get up early on a Sunday morning and join you. Woo-hoo. Baptized in vinegar and winged on sour pickles, you know? It's not attractive, is it? I mean, it really isn't. It really isn't. But what about the transformative thing where you and I begin to live lives that are renewed, that the fruit of the Spirit does begin to come forth from you and I in love and joy and peace and patience and goodness and kindness and faithfulness and gentleness and And self-control. I mean, when those things begin, then there becomes a real witness of the Spirit, a real witness of the transformative power of God in our lives, so that when we come into our circumstances that are beyond our control, when the testing comes our way and we submit ourselves and we're the 20-day or the 40-day kind of people, not the 20-year and the 40-year kind of people, and God is moving in our midst. And so I ask myself, and I don't mean that I get it right every time, but I ask myself that question whenever, when the wilderness comes, okay, how long am I here for? Because I get wilderness times just like you do. And that's the question in my, every time those wilderness times come to me is, how long am I going to be here? And I know the answer rests in my own hands, right? I've read this over and over and over and over again. I've taught this over and over and over again, and I know it rests within my hands to let God have His way and God be God and for me not to be. And yet I find myself so wanting to pick up and to strive and to... But here's what I do know is I don't want my head to go down to Sheol unresolved. I've made it my life's ambition to finish well. I believe the promise that it doesn't matter how you begin or what even the majority of your life is like, it's how you finish that matters most. And so, how long will I be in the wilderness? How long will I be held captive to my trial, my addiction, my situation? As long as my heart remains hard, as long as I would rather self-justify than be rightly justified by Christ. And I listen to the words of Joseph, his words to his brother, "Do not be distressed or angry with yourselves." This is what he's saying to those who put him in the place to suffer for 20 plus years. Is there anyone who's brought you to a point of long-term suffering and you know you need to forgive them, but you don't want to because they've inflicted real pain on you? I mean real pain. Have you ever found yourself back in the same test all over again, that you finally escaped the circumstances only to end up 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years later, repeating the same test all over again? We're not talking about tests that don't matter. We're talking about the ones that do. We are talking about the ones that really exact a price, that really crush and ruin lives. Not just the slight offense, not just the calloused word spoken. Do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. Real sin. For God sent me before you to preserve life. I want that kind of power of the Spirit at work in my life. I want that kind of thing revibrating. I want to be the kind of person, the Joseph kind of person who looks at his circumstances and all of his sufferings and says, God was doing a good thing even while you were doing evil. No longer do I need to hold you accountable. What I need to do is hold me accountable for the growth, for the presence and the power of the Holy Spirit in my life. To remember that my struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and authorities that are at work in this dark world. Stop hating the person I can see. And to deal with the pain that is within, the hardness of heart that is within. What a powerful lesson learned. that God used his pain, his distress, to save. And when we say many, it doesn't just mean his brothers and his dad and their families, but the millions when we think of all of their extended family and all the Egyptian people. That God didn't love Joseph any less, and that God didn't abandon Joseph. And for Joseph to conclude that my sacrifice, my 20 plus years, was worth it so that all these other people might be saved. See, here's the thing, human agency. God uses the actions of people in human agency to redeem, to hope, to give life, to change circumstances. People doing both good and evil. People acting out of selfishness and also out of selflessness. Each one acting on their own, doing their own will. That ultimately God's sovereign will is accomplished on the earth, all the while allowing them their free will. It is beyond my ability to even comprehend the wisdom and the might and the intelligence of God in all of that detail. But it is not beyond my grasp or yours to recognize the application in the life of Joseph and to ask, the next time God answers my prayer, and it seems like it's taking a long time, or it's not going the way I should, or whatever else, that I would have the confidence that Joseph had, that maybe God is doing something in me and through me that is so much bigger than the immediacy of my own pain or discomfort. Maybe consider that the biggest roadblock to my success or the success of my children is not God or others, but maybe it's even myself and my own willingness to be matured, changed, remade. And then let those words echo in the chamber of your heart. What you meant for evil, God meant for good, to save lives and to preserve them. I don't know about you, but I have found out a long time ago, changing people is hard business. I mean, all y'all that are married in here ought to know that by now, right? Should have known that by the end, you know, first 6 weeks were over. Certainly, if you didn't know that by the end of the first year, we need to talk. Well, guess what? It's hard business for God to change our hearts too. Case number one, in the mirror. So, are you a 40-day learner or a 40-year learner? What about getting even? You know, the Bible sets clear limits, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but the truth is that what Jesus calls us to is to forgive. So even so, Joseph's life sets before us an example that echoes throughout the halls of Scripture from Genesis all the way to the end that points to God's hand in everything, even our pain and sorrow, and to ask the question, God, what are you doing? Or Jesus' invitation through the Sermon on the Mount to be a kingdom-hearted people who value relationship over getting even, over judgmentalness, or likewise being judged unjustly, asking us to grant mercy when we have not been given mercy. Because ultimately, the mercy that we need most is the mercies of God. To never equate something that we are doing with earning us a place or a reward, but always with a thought of examining our own heart, doing what is right and just because it is right and just, to be the kind of people who do and say the things that Jesus would do and say in a world that is full of Pharisees and brothers who would do us harm, and but there really isn't much difference, church, in the behavior of the world and the religiosity of Pharisees. And I would submit to you that if you and I don't learn the lessons of Joseph, there's not much difference between a Pharisee and a church person. Hello? Let's stand together, shall we?
I hope you enjoyed our podcast today. If you did, there's two things you could do for me. First, subscribe to our channel. That way, the most recent podcast will always be in your feed, ready when you are. And secondly, if this ministry has impacted you, would you help us to continue to reach others by clicking on the link in the description to give now? Until next time, thank you so much for listening to the Empowered Word.